So we're starting this quarter on apologetics, and I'll be introducing the topic tonight. Myself, Mark, and Ara each kind of have some different areas that each of us is working on that we'll be presenting a little bit back and forth throughout the quarter. So I won't be presenting their topics or introducing them in general. What I want to talk about tonight is the idea of apologetics in general. What are we studying about? What is the importance of it? And I want to start off with four questions, very fundamental questions, and you'll see how fundamental they are, and so fundamental, I'd like an answer, and I'd like it fairly quickly. Does God exist? Okay, got it. Yes, God exists. Is the God of the Bible the real God? Yes. Okay. Is the Bible from God? And is the Bible accurate in all it communicates? Now, I know the Bible records some lies, but I think you got the right answer. Yes. So we're very quickly saying yes to these things. And that is not exactly what this study is about. The study is important because of the following questions. Why do I believe God exists? So we can say we believe he exists, but can we articulate why we believe he exists? And these four questions, it's basically the same four questions, but instead of does God exist, it's why do I believe it? And I want you to answer these to yourself, because I want you to be as open and honest as you can be in answering these questions. This could be taken in a kind of a rational way. How did I arrive at this conclusion? Or what are the logical steps that led me to this? But it could be a historical question as well. How did I come to the point in my life that I began believing that God exists? Actually, there's a question before this. We got some yeses on the previous slide, but I'm not going to assume that everyone believes all of those things. I assume most of you will, but not everyone, or maybe everyone doesn't believe those things to the same degree or feel as confident about them or for the same reasons. So these are kind of historical questions and very personal. There are four similar questions, but I hope we can see a difference in them. How do I know God exists? So depending on how you interpreted why do I believe God exists, how do I know he exists? And I'm not trying to differentiate between belief and knowledge here. It's more between why and how. So I could say, why do I believe God exists? Well, because my parents told me. How do I know that he exists? My parents told me is no longer a sufficient answer. Or someone that I trust tells me that. How do I know the Bible tells about the true God? If there is a God, how do I know the God of the Bible is that God? How can I be certain about that? How do I know the Bible is from him? You could have an account not from God that rightly identifies him. But how do I know that this comes from the God that I have come to know exists? And then how do I know that it is accurate? You could have a God who lies. I don't believe we do, but you could. There are certainly many God concepts that do lie. Just a hallmark of them, untrustworthy. These are the questions that we want to work on this quarter. And I'm not saying that we're going to break all these down between me, Mark, and Ara. But these kinds of questions, how can we be sure that God exists, that the Bible is from God, that the Bible is telling the truth, that we have an accurate account of the world and reality from God? So that's, in general, what we will be studying this quarter. at a very high level. Now we get a little bit to the importance of this. So if, let's say, everyone in the room has firmly said yes to our first four questions. Yes, God exists. Yes, the Bible is from him. Yes, the God of the Bible is the true God. And yes, the Bible is accurate. Show of hands, how many of you have had a firsthand interaction with someone who did not agree with all of those, either in person or we could extend it to the internet, but it's firsthand, not just something you read about happening somewhere? Okay, so almost everyone has encountered this, maybe everyone. How will you respond the next time someone says that to you? They say, God isn't real, the Bible is a myth at best, a deliberate lie at worst, and that you have no hope in this world except to eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. How will you respond to that? And I'm not asking for arguments here. I'm asking for just, you could believe them. That's a response. And there might be someone in this room who has never encountered someone really pushing the issue. And when they start pushing the issue and they start raising some questions you've never asked before, presenting information you've never seen before, whether it's about the veracity of the Bible, whether what we have is what God gave us in the first place, and start causing some doubts and lead us to believe their challenge. That could happen. You could doubt them, but not really know why. Just, that's not what I believe, so I don't believe you. That's maybe better, but it's not a firm foundation to work from. You could disagree vehemently and give bad reasons for it, like, yeah, but your preferred presidential candidate is dumb. I mean, like, or, yeah, but you have funny looking hair. Those aren't good arguments, and we could be really vehement about them. So that could be our response. We could be strong in our position, in our assertions, but not strong in our expression of our convictions. Or you could lovingly, firmly, and fearlessly reject what is false and demonstrate for them the truth. You could present to them convincing proofs that the Bible tells a factual account about a true and living God who came and lived on this earth, died, and was resurrected, and will one day judge us according to the words written in the Bible. You could do that, and hopefully you would, or you would want to. But if this last thing is what happens, it will not be by accident. It will not be because your parents told you God exists and you just went with that. You won't be able to answer someone if that's all you've got. And so we want to equip ourselves to be able to answer those challenges when someone does not already believe basically what we believe or believe the source of truth the same way that we do, or they believe in a different source of truth. So it takes careful study of the evidences around us combined with sound reasoning. So we look at the evidences, we look at the information, and then we are careful in how we consider that information with logical reasoning, sound reasoning, and we come to conclusions that are then sound. We build our faith and our knowledge in what is true that way. We can defend against error that way, and we can go on the offensive to lead others to a right understanding of God's truth. So, what is apologetics? As Leslie pointed out before we got started, learning how to say I'm sorry, but really explain it. No, and I don't know why the word is so similar to apologize. I'm sure there's a reason for it. But it comes from a word, a Greek word, apologia, and forms of that. And you won't see apologetics in your Bible, but you will see English translations of that word. In Acts 24, and several, we're not going to read all these verses, but when time after time, when Paul appears in legal settings to defend his case, defend his innocence in the court, that defense, that is apologia. He is presenting a legal case, a legal argument. So evidence and reasoning. He's taking those two things and presenting them as to why he should be, you know, why the Jews are wrongfully accusing him. So that's all those examples in Acts, and then he speaks of it in 2 Timothy 4:16, that everyone had abandoned him at his first offense. Again, in Acts 22, verse 1, similar setting, only it's an illegal, there's another occasion when he's in Ephesus, and there are people, he wanted to give his defense before the mob. There's an illegal assembly there, but still the same kind of thing. In Acts 22, verse 1, was it Sunday, Wyatt mentioned the ending of Acts 21, and Paul said, well, in Acts 22, verse 1, it says what he said and what he is doing, and what he says is his defense before this mob of Jews who, you know, kind of led into what was going on in Acts 24, 25, 26. So that defense that he's giving. In 1 Corinthians 9, verse 3, and really throughout this whole context, and that's the context we're going to get into here in a couple of minutes, Paul is defending his right as a preacher of the gospel to receive wages from those he preaches to. He is also defending his right to not to do that and still be considered a valid apostle. So he's defending his decision there. So that defense is another example of apologia. And we'll see, we'll look at how he comes to those conclusions and how he defends them. Philippians 1, verse 7 and 16 uses the phrase, his defense and confirmation of the gospel. And then 1 Peter 3:15, we're going to spend some time looking at that context, of course. That's just a perfect example of what we're talking about in this quarter, being always ready to make a defense. And that's what we're trying to do. Before we get into 1 Corinthians 9, you can be turning there. Any comments so far? Questions? All right, well, let's look at 1 Corinthians 9 and look at Paul's example of his apologetics. Now, what he's defending here is not something we're going to spend any time past this class looking at. We're not, you know, our first four questions were not, is it proper to pay a preacher who's preaching for you? That's not one of those four. But the way that he approaches truth is very relevant here. So let's look at the way that Paul defends first his right. He calls it, do I not have a right to eat and drink? That's in verse 4. Do we not have a right to eat and drink? Can somebody give us background to your understanding based on what seems to be implied here? What was going on? Why he would say a right to eat and drink? Is he somebody trying to starve him, or why?
Chapter 8, when he's talking about, is it lawful to eat or to eat meat offered to idols, and where he explains that it depends on whether the person knows for that purpose.
Okay. Yeah, I think there is definitely a thematic connection there, a logical connection there, in terms of his reasoning that we're going to talk about in chapter 9 applies back in chapter 8. It's a way of life that he talks about there. I don't personally believe that's specifically what he's talking about. You might have any other ideas.
David. for being supported enough to subsist. Like, you know, 2 Thessalonians 3 about if anyone's not willing to work, he's not to eat either. Getting at that idea of being able to support yourself.
Yeah. I agree, David, and the reason I do is because the arguments he makes after that all relate to a worker receiving wages. And he compares himself to other workers in the gospel who nobody disagreed. Yeah, of course they can receive wages. They can support themselves. They can support their family through that. So when he says, do we not have a right to eat and drink, what he's saying is, do we not have right to receive income, or we might call it support, for the preaching of the gospel? Paul supported himself in other ways, himself and those with him in other ways. He would receive support from other churches. He calls it robbing them, which is an exaggeration to prove a point that, or demonstrate a point that really the Corinthians ought to be supporting him. But as we'll see, there are reasons that he didn't ask them to, and he wouldn't accept it from them. So he would receive support from other churches, or he would work with his own hands to support himself and those who were with him. But his point here is he doesn't have to, and what seems to be happening, and this is where I'm inferring based on, seems like he's responding to some critics. And the critics are saying, Paul's not a real apostle. The real apostles get paid. Peter gets paid. We know he's real, but Paul doesn't take any wages from you, so he can't be a real apostle, and therefore, you don't need to listen to him. You should listen to whoever. That seems to be what he's addressing here. So the arguments that he makes, let's look at verse 5 and 6. There's a specific argument, but then there's, what kind of argument is this? In verse 5 he says, do we not have a right to take along a believing wife, even as the rest of the apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or do only Barnabas and I not have a right to refrain from working? So I'm saying this is an argument from consistency. Do we ever encounter those kinds of arguments? Or maybe the opposite, somebody's being inconsistent. Can you see what is the argument, the consistency argument here? Can we rephrase what he's saying? If Peter has a right, and you agree with that, if you're going to be consistent, and that's the phrase, you use it in your internet arguments. If you're going to be consistent, you've got to apply this reasoning over here to this set of facts over here. And Paul's saying, let's be consistent. And that's, if we're going to be consistent, we can determine, come to the conclusion that yes, he does have a right to have a family and not have to work additionally to the work in the gospel. Verse 7, who at any time serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat the fruit of it? Or who tends a flock and does not use the milk of the flock? This is similar to the first argument, but how is it different? Okay, the first one is very specific. Here's these other preachers. I'm a preacher. It's just like these things are exactly the same. And I think we can all see that's a valid argument. We're talking about the exact same thing. We should be very consistent there. Paul steps away from that specific comparison, and he looks at a more universal principle. Not just preachers. Anybody who works deserves to reap a reward from the work that they do. A soldier serving at his own expense is like the opposite of that. He's paying to go do someone else's fighting. If you're planting a vineyard, then of course you're going to reap some benefit from it. If you're going to tend a flock, then yes, of course you're going to be able to use the milk of the flock. So I'm calling, I don't know if anybody uses these terms besides me, but I'm calling it an argument from similarity. This is a similar situation. It's not the exact same situation, but it's similar. And so we can use that same kind of reasoning when the conditions are similar. Now, the way that works in argumentation is if someone wants to disagree with them, they have to do one of two things. They have to say, no, it's not similar, or no, your premise is wrong. Soldiers do go to war at their own expense. No one drinks the milk from their flock, and no one eats the fruit from the vineyards that they tend. So they have to prove one of those things. Either his facts are wrong or his reasoning does not apply. And that would be a difficult thing to say in this situation, especially when that's not his only argument. Next one, verse 9 through 10. For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing. God is not concerned about oxen, is he? Or is he speaking altogether for our sake? And then in verse 13, it's the same kind of argument. Do you not know that those who perform sacred services eat the food of the temple, and those who attend regularly to the altar have their share from the altar? Now, again, he's doing a comparison. But what is the strength of this argument here? Okay, we have a law. This is not just how everybody does it. Like, okay, it's not just a generally accepted practice anymore. Now it is an authoritative standard. And so he's appealing to an authority, and that's something that we have to watch out for, because if we just appeal to the authorities and the authorities don't have authority, that's a bad argument. But he's appealing to the authority, because they're not concerned with the four questions that we have, right? They're already agreeing, yes, God spoke truth and he had good principles. He was establishing good commands in the old law. And so we can learn something from them. So he argues from this authoritative precedent, not just a similar thing that happens to be true. So when we appeal to a valid authority, then that can be a strong argument. In verse 11, if we sowed spiritual things in you, is it too much if we reap material things from you? What is the unstated principle or fact or reality that relates the two parts of this statement that makes it a good argument? There's an assumption here.
Life, you're not going to give me a loaf of bread.
Okay. It's still unstated. Okay. That's the assumption that makes what you said true and what makes Paul said true. Now, if somebody disagreed and they said, no, the physical is much more valuable than the spiritual, then this is not a valid argument. But when he says, if we sowed spiritual things in you, great value, things of great value, not Walmart, cheap brand. If we sowed things of immense value in you, can't you give us this small thing of relatively inconsequential value? Well, of course you can. That kind of argument is called a fortiori. I ran across that in our previous study. I'm not big on remembering the Latin, but that's what it's called. This argument from the lesser to the greater, or you can go the other way. It depends on what point you're trying to make. But if this lesser thing is true, how much more? And that's the phrase. If you just remember, how much more? This lesser thing is true, how much more this greater thing? And so he's talking about there's also kind of a fairness of this exchange here. I'm giving you a great thing. It's reasonable for you to give me a lesser thing in exchange. Verse 12. If others share the right over you, do we not more so? Nevertheless, we did not use this right, but we endure all things so that we will cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. So if others share the right over you, do we not more? I'm calling this moral fairness. If it's fair for others to do this, this is also a lesser to greater. Who gave the Corinthians more, these other preachers who just came in after Paul and did some things, or Paul who brought the gospel to them, who labored so much for them. If they accept that from the lesser, then of course they should accept that they should be able to support him in his preaching because of, he's done so much more work among them, and that's only fair in a moral sense. And finally, verse 14, so also the Lord directed those who proclaimed the gospel to get their living from the gospel. What is the assumption that makes this argument valid? Why?
Does God exist? Question.
That is a very fundamental assumption for it. So God exists. If there is no God, then who is this fictional being you're saying? Okay? And let's take it a step further. He exists and he has the authority, he has the final say. He is the Lord. He is the master. And if the master says those who proclaim the gospel can get their living from the gospel, then that's the truth. So this is the strongest argument, but it's only a strong argument for someone who already believes in the authority of the Lord. But they do, so it is a very strong argument. That's just, he could have just said that, but after laying down all of these arguments, there's no way you can work around it. It's very clear Paul had that right. All right, so this he goes on to make another defense, and I think that's a great example of how it is a very valid thing and an important skill to have to be able to reason. You don't have to remember Latin argument names and whatever, but be able to use facts and reason to get to sound conclusions. And Paul didn't just come in and exercise the authority, beat him with the authority stick. The Lord said, he used reason so that they would buy into it. They would get it. They wouldn't need, they maybe they didn't even need the last point, but maybe a few of them were still like stubborn. And so he had to, you know, because I said so, because the Lord said so. Sometimes that's what you have to use. So there's a second thing that Paul has to defend here. That's, so it's kind of funny. He spends all this time arguing, I have the right. But remember, back to kind of the issue here is people are saying Paul's not an apostle because he doesn't use the right. Now he's got to defend that as well. And I want to notice something different about his explanation here. His approach is just different to this argument. So what he has to defend here is why am I not using this right that I just spent several, you know, a section of this letter explaining to you in multiple ways why I can. Let's start in verse 12. We read the focused on the first half of it, but the second half of it, we did not use this right, but we endure all things so that we will cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. So his specific explanation here is, I did not want to hinder the gospel. And so that's, I'm calling this an external motivation. Sorry, Mark, I'm wandering around and can see the board. So he's got this external motivation from other people. He's thinking about others. When I say external, he's thinking about others in that motivation. What is he talking about? To cause no hindrance to the gospel. How could him receiving wages possibly interfere with whether people would listen to his preaching? I don't think it's a hard one. Ed?
People would say he's doing it for the money.
And if he didn't take the money, they say he's not. He's in that situation like Jesus and John the Baptist where if he comes not eating and drinking, they say he has a demon, and if he eats and drinks, they say he's a glutton and a drunkard. They're going to reject it either way. Paul's in that situation. If he takes the money, he's worried that people will say he's doing it for the money. If he doesn't take the money, he's dealing with what he's dealing with. He didn't take the money because he did not want to cause any hindrance to the gospel. He didn't want anybody saying he's a televangelist. Even though he wasn't, he didn't want that appearance. He was careful about that. Verse 15, I have used none of these things, and I am not writing these things so that it will be done so in my case, for it would be better for me to die than have any man make my boast an empty one. I'm saying his argument here is focused on his purpose. If I have a purpose and doing this doesn't align with that purpose, why would I do it? And so he points out his purpose. If his boast, as he calls it, if his claim is that he is a messenger from Christ, with a message from Christ, and he's working to save these people, and he can claim, I brought you the gospel. And they need to remember that because it is the gospel and not listen to other men who are not teaching that. If that's his purpose, then they should be ready to accept that he's going to do some maybe extreme things, unusual things to fulfill that purpose, like not take wages when he could take the wages. It would be contrary to his purpose with this group of people. Verse 17, for if I do this voluntarily, I have a reward. But if against my will, I have a stewardship entrusted to me. So he's got an internal motivation too. He's looking out for the Corinthians for sure. But he's also saying, there's something in it for me. If I do what's right, if I make this sacrifice, I know God notices. And I have a reward. Now, there's a reward from Christ. There's also the reward of seeing the Corinthians not being distracted by him taking money. So there's maybe multiple rewards here. But if he does it voluntarily, that only happens if he's doing it voluntarily and not for the money. In verse 19 through 22, he's going to defend his own trustworthiness, and he's going to step away from the immediate topic at hand and say, this is just part of how I am. It's consistent. It's a consistency argument that applied to himself. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all so that I may win more. He's saying, this is what I do. To the Jews I became as a Jew so that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, so that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, so that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became as weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that I may by all means save some. But he has not left his topic yet. He's saying this specific instance is just how I live. Whether it's Jew, non-Jew, weak, strong, whatever the case may be, I'm going to take the hits so that I can do what's necessary to win people to Christ. Now, if they want to argue, no, Paul, you're doing this because you're not a real apostle, or if you took the money, it'd be because you're wanting some gain out of it. You could show, how much gain do I have? Like, look at my life. But he can say, that doesn't fit every single time. You look at any part of my life, and it's consistent with this approach. What could destroy that argument if it was different than Paul's situation? What destroys a consistency argument? Inconsistency. So if this was like the only time that Paul said he was looking out for people and you could tell, and all the other times it's looking out for number one, himself, they wouldn't buy this argument. But if he is consistent, it's a strong argument that that is his motivation. Similar to this, all of these are very closely related, but they kind of look at different angles. Ed. Oh.
And that is that. That was in contrast to what was going on in the political, you know, politically and with the Jewish leaders. They were doing things, they were very motivated with the things that they were doing. They were benefiting directly from the things that they were telling people. So Paul is standing in stark contrast to what they were used to.
I can't remember if it's Paul or Peter, someone says, making merchandise of you. Like, the people are the product, and they're like, they're being used by other people, but not Paul. Yeah. Yeah, so there's a contrast. There's consistency on his side. In a sense, there's consistency on the other side. It might show up in inconsistent ways. But verse 23, anybody else? 23, the first part of that. I do all things for the sake of the gospel. So this is his higher calling, and he's saying, this is why I'm doing it. So he's got a higher objective. And then the second part of that verse, so that I may become a fellow partaker of it. He wants to share in the blessings with those that he sacrificed for. In other translations, I think it's fellow partaker with them. Those people that he, the weak, that he became weak for. He wanted to partake in the gospel with them. So he's got this charitable outlook. It's not just a higher calling. It's a higher calling with love for fellow man in it. And then finally, it's consistent with his foundation for his life. In verse 25, everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air, but I discipline my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. He lived his life with purpose. He didn't just claim purpose. He didn't just claim a higher calling. He lived that way. All right. We've got just a few minutes. We'll hit some of this if I need to. We'll pick it up in the next class next week. What specifically are we defending? I've kind of talked about this already. We could be defending anything. And so we can prepare for various defenses in different ways. We could be defending the plan of salvation in apologetics. The work worship organization of church is the biblical views on sexual immorality. That's not the focus of this class unless Mark or Ira surprises us. For this class, it will be, in some way, these foundational beliefs that all these other things depend on. Without these, if God doesn't exist, obviously the Bible can't be from God. If the Bible is not accurate, then we can't make any arguments from it, and so forth. So these are foundational things that we have to defend. We're defending the foundation of the walls. All right. Just got a couple minutes. Tell you what, I want anybody to speak who has a chance. I want to ask this question this time, and we'll answer it next time. What do you hope to get out of the class? And I think we've already got our topics picked out, but I want you to be thinking about how you're going to use this information, and if there's any feedback, anything that we can take in, that we can, you know, massage the approach to the class so that we can... So you can get some benefit out of it. I'm going to skip ahead to 1 Peter 3:15. This will be a good place to end it. 1 Peter 3:15. Might even come back to this. But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you. So that is our goal here, is to get ready. Now, as we look into the context of 1 Peter 3, and we'll do this more next week, we see getting ready has a number of different aspects to it. Part of it is mental. Part of it is knowledge. Part of it is getting our heart ready, our courage ready. And they were dealing with some stuff that needed courage, and we do too. So there's various things that need to be prepared and a way to go about it that we need to keep in the front of our mind when we think about our purpose here. Our purpose in the class is to learn, but then we take this information, we do something with it. We need to be thinking about that purpose, and that's what I'd like you to be thinking about. How do you envision using what you gain from the class. And we'll talk about that some more next time. That's our time. Thank you for your participation, and look forward to the rest of the studies.